And welcome to Dakota Midday Tech Radio for this May 9th. Our 800 number is 1-800-524-3604. You can also send us an email. Send it to midday@sdpb.org. If you have any questions or comments you'd like on today's show, we would be happy to talk about them or solve any problems or pass anything along. We enjoy that. Today's panelists are Mac guru Joel Brovelite. SDN's sales engineer Amos Asup is here. And from Peer, Jeff Litterick, a technology integration specialist with BIT. So we have a host of folks standing by to take your questions and calls and emails. Please do that. Again, 800-524-3604. You can tweet us at SDPB, or the email is midday, M-I-D-D-A-Y, at sdpb.org. Well, guys, you know, something I didn't really put on the agenda for today, but I'm going to throw out there as a kind of the icebreaker of the show. You know, Mother's Day, obviously, weighs heavily on all our minds at this time. For the special person in your life, are you planning any tech gifts for this weekend? Amos, let's start with you.
You know, tech gifts for my mom, always an interesting choice. You have to go with the things that are easy to use, but I don't have one planned for this time, but the most recent, would have been Christmas, I guess, she did get a Roku. So there are occasions when I do get my mom Christmas presents or gifts that would be tech-related, but not this weekend.
Yeah, have you seen the Roku stick that's out now?
I have not.
It's like a Chromecast stick, goes inside of your TV. You can remote it from your phone or with the handy little remote control that comes with it. It's like $49.
Really?
Yeah.
I have a Chromecast, and I use it quite frequently, but so I can understand why Roku would want to get in on that game.
Yeah, anyway, I saw that actually as one of the, you know, you read on the internet, you read all the tech tips and the, you know, top 10 gifts for mom under $50 for Mother's Day and all that kind of stuff. And people can just Google search that and they'll find all that kind of stuff out there. But yeah, I thought that was a great addition, particularly because of Chromecast, you know, a very similar type device to that. Anyway, Jeff Litterick, anything, accessories or cases for... Well, the new Kindles aren't coming with cases, so a lot of people are kind of upset. So that seems to be top of mind with a lot of people. But anything on your list?
Probably prepaying, especially if they don't have it already, Netflix, because Netflix is raising its price on all its customers here next week, on new customers only. So if you want to lock in something or they express an interest, maybe a prepaid year of that is actually a pretty good deal right now. Otherwise, you know, the cases, there's always new phones coming out, and every new phone, of course, needs a new case and touch screen protectors and stuff like that. And I highly recommend these things because I walk the halls around here, and I would say one in four phones has cracked screens and has been that way for at least 6 months as they just have to live with them. Cases do protect that stuff. If your parents have stuff, make sure everything has proper cases. You don't want to get a new phone or have a phone for 2 months to crack the screen and have to live with it for 2 years. So
yeah, that would be very bad. Joel?
Yes, sir.
Good afternoon.
Good day.
Anything anything on your list?
Tech gifts from my mother.
Yeah.
You know. And this isn't really a tech gift, but, you know, maybe you can turn it into one. It'd be a free and or cheap one. And I've probably mentioned on this on the show before, one of the things that I help my mother out with all the time is she has an iPhone. I'm sure everybody out there would be surprised to know that she uses an Apple phone. they'd be surprised, by the way, that Amos is sitting in front of a MacBook Air. Everybody should be surprised
what?
That Amos is using a Mac.
I don't know.
Currently.
Cats and dogs are getting along. It's crazy.
So I just had to. I couldn't get past that, really, since I walked in. Anyway, one of the things that I do is I have her set up, you know, in kind of a location. I have her location data sent to my phone. It's really easy to do if you have an iPhone, so that if she can't find her phone, I can go ahead and send a sound to it so she can find it somewhere in the house. If this has happened, she gets lost on the back roads going out to visit family, I've directed her using that. I think it's easily one of the best features of the iPhone or really any phone if you have somebody who maybe needs help from time to time to go ahead and have that turned on. You may have a relative that could really use that, and it wouldn't cost you anything but go in and turn the settings on for them since they're not going to be able to do it, and you can kind of help them out from time to time.
Do you ever just go over to her house and hide the phone and then go have her make noises and make her scavenger hunt?
You're just a horrible person, Ken. I would never do that to my mother. Not now. Maybe, you know,
April
1st
of next
year. But not now. I'm an adult now.
Okay. Hey, that's a great idea, and it's not stalkery at all.
Well, of course you. I mean, I don't have to tell our astute listeners that that's something that you do when you've discussed it with the person and say, hey, you know, this might help you out if you lose your phone. The reverse might be true. You might want to tell your spouse or your wife, hey, I'm going to turn this on so that you can help me find my phone if it gets lost. I told that story about a year ago where my wife lost her phone in a parking lot, and I was able to track it down when she called me from a separate phone, mm-hmm. and we found it in 5 minutes. That could work for everybody, but what a great thing you could do for an aunt or a mother or a grandmother if they've got a device that would allow you to do that.
You know, and it seems like it would work the reverse as well for the children.
Of course,
you would want to know where they are. And
yeah, if they need help. Phone. Of course, absolutely.
Yeah, it's a chunk of money and technology that's out there floating around, and you pretty much want to know where that's at. I see
for
that.
Sure.
Yeah. Hey, a reminder to listeners, if you like a list of the links that we talk about on today's show, we post those either during the show or shortly thereafter on our Facebook page, facebook.com/techradio is where to do that. So this is your chance to call for help on SDPB Radio, 800-524-3604, the number, 368-1677 or 368-1NPR is the number to text. And our email address is midday, M-I-D-D-A-Y, at sdpb.org. Joel, let's kind of stick with you. We have some, you can't turn the TV on or your Twitter feed or anything without seeing Dr. Dre and Apple in the news this morning.
Yes, so, that actually kind of went through late last night.
Is it actually a deal or is it just a rumor?
No, it's more than a rumor. But it's not a deal yet. It hasn't been inked yet.
Okay.
But the story is out there that Apple is going to attempt to purchase for $3.2 billion Beats. I think Beats Mobile is the name of the actual company. But
Beats,
if you're not familiar, with it, they make high end headphones, earbuds, and they also released basically on Super Bowl Sunday, the music service that they have, a subscription music service, kind of similar to Spotify or maybe Pandora, if you're familiar with those. It's a subscription service. You can kind of, it's all you can eat. Their flagship, of course, is their
programming support
headphones.
Provided by Mount Marty College.
Wow. All right.
Yeah, and our programming support is supported by
Beats Audio
College.
By Dr. Dre.
Yeah, right, for sure. Yeah. And I sent this in an email. It's not just Dr. Dre. Jimmy Iovine was the other big name who was also a founder of Beats, although I'm not sure, you know, who owns what. But they're both huge names. And there's a lot of question, you know, why would Apple spend $3.2 million on a kind of not very popular, at least at this point, music service and a high-end headphone manufacturer? And frankly, when you say high-end headphone manufacturer, I'm surprised people even have a question. That is right in Apple's wheelhouse. They were the first ones to sell the Beats headphones. Dr. Dre is an old Apple master, which is a program Apple has where, you know, they give technology to, you know, Dr. Dre and Jimmy Iovine, who is a former friend of Steve Jobs, and they've had a long connection through Apple and through Steve Jobs. They make high-end products that are really popular with the kids. In fact, I was reading an article this morning that said, why does Apple want to buy a headphone manufacturer that's popular with the kids? I'm like, you answered your own question in the headline.
Because they make a lot of money.
And it's right in their wheelhouse. And it's a great brand name. Beats, the brand name, people, they put stickers on their car, much like they do with Apple logo stickers. They license it out to skateboard manufacturers. It's promoted at concerts. You see stickers on the back of laptops at at shows. Jimmy Iovine is seen wearing Beats headphones 100% of the time. If you've ever watched American Idol when he was on, wearing his headphones. It's just such a great brand. Is it worth $3.2 million? Hard to tell, but...
Billion.
Hard to tell. However, what I can tell you is Apple was not able to compete, even though they tried, both with the music streaming service, although that's a smaller player, and certainly with the high-end audio. So it's a big deal. There's a lot of question about why, but it seems pretty silly. $3.2 billion is... just a fraction of what Apple has sitting in the bank.
Well, they've got $150 billion hanging around, getting moldy, and they say that the real hawks on this, the financial people, say that they're really overpaying. But you know what? The facts are is that Beats is a money making company right now.
And yeah, I mean, if you could name another headphone manufacturer that has as big a name, I would be shocked. Certainly that has a name and is for sale. I mean, I wouldn't have even thought Beats was for sale. I was thinking the other day, I'm like, man, that company's getting big. So I just don't think you could name another headphone manufacturer, certainly that quality and that name brand recognition.
Well, I think for enough money, they probably all are.
Well, yeah, but can you name one that's as big, as huge a name?
Sennheiser?
But I see a lot of people wearing Sennheiser headphones. Oh, you're wearing, you got the new Sen.
No, other than me.
Well, you got the new generic black headphones that look like every other.
I wasn't going to bring it up because it has a lot to do with this Mac sitting in front of me as well. But, you know, the Beats headphones are a huge marketing coup. They really are. And while they're better than your standard Skullcandy off-the-shelf kind of headphones, they really don't. They're not high-end headphones. They're nice headphones, but they aren't what... To me, if I was going to spend $400 on a pair of headphones, it would not be Beats. However...
Well, yeah, you sound like the kind of guy that would not spend $400 on a pair of Beats.
I actually have a pair of $350 headphones, but they're not Beats.
Yeah.
But that's because I use them in a different environment. It's more on a professional
of
level.
Of course, yeah.
And it's not there because I want to look... A, I'm probably the wrong demographic. Mm-hmm. I'm a little bit too old.
You are.
And B, it's...
So am I.
It's just, you know, understanding the technical aspects of it. There are some equivalent or better solutions.
Absolutely.
But you're right. Whether or not some of the brand name recognition type sites that sell headphones being for sale, you know, the next one I can think of that would have the name recognition would be like what Keeley is wearing there, the Sonys. Yeah. That's not for sale for $3 billion.
No, certainly not. It certainly doesn't have that name brand recognition for headphones. I know we're talking about something that seems very trivial.
Right.
But it's not at all.
Well,
I mean, even the market is not trivial. I mean,
sure.
You just said at $350 for a set of headphones sounds like a lot.
Yeah.
And it is, but they sell off the shelves. You know, you go through Target, and they're one of the few sets of headphones that have the security wire and a little paint device or whatever on it.
Because they cost so much.
And they moved into other audio, too. I saw someone who had a Beats Pill.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
They make Bluetooth speakers, and they make
all sorts of audio stuff.
And those were really nice. Mm-hmm. I liked those, too.
Yeah, I don't think anybody's saying that that they make the best audio equipment out there. Frankly, if anybody ever says this is the best audio anything, they're lying or they don't really know because... Every audio anything is good for something and not as good for something else, and it's all so up to opinion.
So do you suppose the value here of $5 billion, are they placing more value on the headphones / physical products
the
they
name.
Sell versus the audio?
The audio service? It's totally about the audio services. It has nothing to do with headphones. But
I think you're wrong. I think they looked at it, and this is just me guessing, but I think they looked at it and said, hey, audio service, yeah, we can use that brand. That's good. Their product is good. Hey, these headphones, most popular in the market, that's good. But I think the biggest part of that $3.2 billion is the name recognition, the name brand.
Sure.
That's what they wanted. And the people behind it, Dr. Dre, Jimmy Iovine, I think they get that in the deal. I think that's the biggest part of the deal. I don't know that the streaming service is really that big a deal to them. At least that's not the way I look at it yet. And certainly the hardware, Apple's got great engineers. They could make great products just like that, but just didn't tap the market like Beats did. I think it's a good buy, frankly.
All right. Well, yeah, it'll all play out and we'll all see. But the fact of the matter is that every professional athlete you see on television in a press conference or before a game or after a game or whatever, they're wearing Beats. And, you know, you go to any state, frankly, you go to any South Dakota state tournament, and what are the kids wearing? They're wearing Beats. And so you get that kind of a brand into a home and you tie it in with Apple
good things are going to happen. You know, I mean, and you know, for everybody out there listening, well, why would I spend so much on a good pair of headphones, whether it's Beats or not? The nice part about a good set of headphones is you change your phone, you change your computer, you change your music device, you get to keep the headphones. You don't have to change that every time. So I think there are a lot of people out there, especially young people, that look at that as more of an investment than maybe some of these devices that they rotate through over the years. So
yeah,
it's not a bad investment if you are really interested in good quality.
Yeah. Well, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we've got a quick question about Adobe Audition CS6 on a Mac. So we'll get you to answer that one, Joel. And, of course, we're going to talk we'll talk a little security with Jeff Litterick and Peer and a few other things. So we'll take this quick break. Be right back. And we are back to Dakota Midday Tech Radio on this fantastic May 9th. Our 800 number is 1-800-524-3604. You can send us emails. That's midday@sdpb.org. Similar to this one we received from a person in Vermilion. It says, I have Adobe Audition CS6 on my Mac, and I've recently tried to save audio files to an external hard drive. However, when I tried that, the message, the target directory is not writable, pops up. What do I need to do to my external hard drive so that audio files start saving there?
Awesome. I don't even have to Google. I can do this one. I could close my computer. I don't need any. This happens a lot, and it's not Adobe Audition or any other program, I'm guessing.
Okay.
I should put the caveat that I could be wrong here, but I think what is happening is the external hard drive that you're trying to write to is probably formatted for Windows or for DOS or FAT32 or not a Mac volume. Mm-hmm. So you're going to want to get everything off of there that you need to get off of there and format the drive from your Mac for a Mac, put everything back on, and if that's what you need to do, and then just save it to it, and you're good to go. Alternately, just go get another drive, format that, save it to that. That's what the problem is.
All right. Very good. We had I'm going to throw this in your court, first of all, Joel, just to have you start with it. But I had a question from a guy. He's looking at doing some, like, home remodeling and, a little bit of light construction, that sort of thing. And he sees on TV these folks using, I guess it used to be a Google company called SketchUp. And he sees them on TV using this thing, and what it does is it allows you to build a layout of a house or a new room or whatever.
It's
and you
a can CAD program.
It's a CAD program. You fly through it. You do stuff. And he's really interested in learning all about, well, what the requirements are of the program, getting some training and some other stuff. He was asking, where do I go to find mentorship in this type of a thing? Or are there folks – can he do that in the state? Is there a place to go – take classes, learn, get mentorship, find people?
Well, I would recommend, if you want to go to a physical location to learn Google SketchUp, which, again, is a CAD program used for, you know, whether it's home building or drafting, you can use it for all sorts of things, furniture production, laying out your garden. It has lots of uses because it's a Google program and can be built on by third parties. There's lots of resources out there. Frankly, the first place I would go is to forum, you can just Google SketchUp forum, and there's several different kind of user-based forums, and that's just a place where people post messages, questions, problems, and walkthroughs, and just it's all text-based. That's a great way to go to get your feet wet. Another way, if you want some training, again, free, go to YouTube. I think YouTube would be and probably is the number one place to learn a product like Google SketchUp, maybe specifically Google SketchUp. If that's not your kind of thing, you might find it hard in South Dakota to find direct training on that program, because it's basically, well, there's a free, it's a kind of a free program. So there, and it's not necessarily used by kind of the industry, at least the professional industry. There are other professional programs that are used, whether it's, well, I can name a few, but that's not what he's interested in. I think going online using Google, and then certainly using YouTube is going to be your best way through training. I know that there are programs that you can get videos, that you can download them. I think that's the way to do it, especially if you're going to use a computer program. You might as well train on the computer, too.
Yeah, it's kind of at your own pace. And go ahead, Jeff.
Yeah, one other thing I will insert, there are some professional training organizations that do offer classes in Sioux Falls and Minneapolis that may offer a class in this. I don't use the program myself, for sure, mm-hmm. but there are... They do tend to run expensive, but there are organizations out there, and the global one is global. Is this not coming off my tongue right now? That do offer and train in very specific programs and a lot of different ones, including Google Apps, and they're like the day course, the 2-day courses. Also, last year, and I don't know if this will repeat, Google actually came to Sioux Falls and had a 2-day. Seminar on their products and a little bit of user training on how to use them, not sure on this product, but they actually came to kind of train more businesses in Google Apps and Docs and stuff, but they did it last year. Maybe they'll come back this year. Maybe look for that. So that's another possibility too, but most of your current fast direct stuff is going to be online off forums and other user groups that use the same product.
Yeah, I'm not sure they're still a Google company, but they were. Anyway, that's good information. Perhaps Jeff, you can paste that link on the Facebook page, and we'll go from there for some training information, because it's not just this; it's a lot of other ones that folks are looking for. Another question, actually, from our Facebook page. Sue writes, "Hey guys, I don't use Internet Explorer, as there are much better browsers available. With all the hacking and, well, you know, generally with all the things you hear about Internet Explorer, she wants to uninstall it." One question, or actually two questions, can you actually do that?
And, no.
I was going to say, can you do that? And her second question was, will it affect any other software?
Technically, you can. Your Windows box will stop running and will refuse to boot up or actually do anything afterwards. Internet Explorer is, and its libraries and procedure calls, which are kind of technical terms, is kind of a core function of the OS. The OS has to have the basis of IE to run. And there's a lot of stuff running by other programs and the OS in the background using IE that you're never aware of. And while it's not actually surfing the web, it uses the local code of IE to display stuff on your screen, even if it's not going out to the internet. So, no, you can't get rid of it. You can delete the icons and stuff so you don't use it, but you can't uninstall it without seriously damaging the computer itself and probably requiring an entire operating system reinstall.
Interesting design. Okay, I just thought of a question, and I guess I don't actually get to ask my own questions on the show very often. I've been hearing a lot about, one thing, and have you heard about the city of Munich? They recently converted like 15,000 computers over to Linux. Have you kind of heard the kerfuffle about that? I guess Microsoft's not really happy.
Especially in Europe, there's been a lot of governments that have done that, and some have gone one way and then come back to Windows and then gone back. There's even some, and it's kind of like here in America, a couple of cities done this. They've also like moved to Google everything, and they moved it back, and moved to. There's always a flex kind of going on, so there's always these kind of projects going on. Some of them work, some of them do not. It's every organization has its own requirements of what has to work and not work, and the success of those kind of things can depend on those requirements.
So here's my question. Been hearing about these people that take a stick or a USB stick or whatever, and you can actually run Linux off of a USB stick, and mm-hmm. we've all heard lots of talk on this show about being able to run apps and things off of a stick. Could you potentially buy a USB stick, install the right software on it, and then just jam that in your Windows XP machine, and that's you don't have to do anything else? You could just run that instance of Linux off the USB drive and go merrily along your way?
Yes, you can, with the caveat, remembering. One thing we should point out, especially as more people get SSD drives, which are basically flash hard drives, right? You install your OS as you run your apps off those. The USB key is no different. It's just a flash drive. In fact, it's the same chips with a little bit of caveats. There is no difference between functionally an SSD drive and a USB. Anything you can do on your hard drive, you can do on the USB.
I see what you're saying. Okay.
Everything. So the caveat is that many USB flash drives, especially the cheaper ones, are very, very slow. You will see speed degradation versus a high, a good hard drive, or especially an SSD, will be much, much faster. But you pay more for those devices for the same memory capacity.
Sure.
You can get USB keys that are fast and stuff, especially with USB 3.0 specs, but you do have to pay more for those keys. You can't, chimp on the key if you need the speed. But if you're willing to live with a little bit of performance degradation and stuff, then from running it natively, yes, you can do whatever you want. You can boot off them. You can run programs. You can store stuff. It's no different than a hard drive. It's like you taking the hard drive of your laptop and just moving it to another machine and sticking it in there and booting up off of it.
This intrigues me. I may have to find a flash drive and try that, because it really sounds interesting. And
what's really interesting, and one of the reasons why you cannot do this with Windows, is unlike just about everything else, Windows actually kind of fingerprints the system when you install it. So when you change the hardware, you move it to another computer, it's brand new hardware, it needs to be reactivated, and it doesn't know what's going on and doesn't have the correct drivers. So Windows, you can't really do that with, because Microsoft made it that way,
mm-hmm.
and they license it that way so that you cannot do it. But just about any other OS, you can do that, as long as it's the hardware, there's key. You plug it into hardware that is supported by that operating system.
Sounds like I need to get back into that a little bit. It's been a number of years since I've sat upon the doorstep of Linux, and I think it's probably come a long way, and it's time to check that out again. While I got you on the line, Jeff, report out today or in the last few days that we're approaching that 1 month after sort of date of Heartbleed, which again is that, am I correct, it's a security vulnerability with there's a fancy name for it, but basically that little padlock that's supposed to alert you that everything that you send between you and the server is confidential, but
the
it's
SSL
not.
SSL. That's what,
So we're 30 days out from that when that big announcement, and I think everybody on the planet that could sit upright and receive news probably heard about that. But they're saying that there's still about 300,000 servers that aren't patched or are still vulnerable.
Well, 300,000 that they can detect on the internet. There mm-hmm. are probably, I would estimate, probably a couple million to maybe 4 million inside networks that are not necessarily publicly accessible, but still accessible at a local level within businesses and companies and government agencies. This is going to take a long time, and a long time to fix, just because, software, when you make changes, you have to do testing and regression to make sure you don't break other stuff. And a lot of people are still doing that. And a lot of people still don't even realize their servers may be insecure, because they only patch once a month or once every 3 or 6 months, and they don't even check to see if there's security updates. They just do it on a regular basis, if at all. So this is something that's going to be out there for a very, very long time. There's some browser extensions that can tell you if you go to a site that still has this issue, so you know not to log in and to, not use that site for sensitive stuff. The problem is, I'm getting conflicting reports that, those extensions miss a lot of sites and are not actually reporting accurately if the site is vulnerable or not. So I can't really recommend them at this point. But if you do know your site is vulnerable that you use, like your banking site or any place you store information, you have to realize that anything you put on that site, you type your username, your password, could be broken at any time and it could be compromised at any time. So.
All right. So, yeah, well, I imagine that there will be security companies that will create programs and tests and things you can run against your local network and your servers and things to detect that if they need more reliable ones than are available now.
And one of the good things is many of the antivirus companies now are triggering on this. So if they have, and it's not something a user's antivirus could catch, but for the companies running, if you have an antivirus, it should be warning you about this. And your internal system should be warning, hey, this is a problem, you need to fix this stuff. But it's really up to the company to patch and fix it. So there's not much the end user can really do except complain to the company, hey, you need to patch your systems.
Well, speaking of antivirus, Joel, you passed along a link earlier this week. And apparently we want to talk about this today because the Symantec is coming out and saying, well, I don't know if I believe this headline, but antivirus software is dead. Can you want to explain that a little bit?
Well, I can tell you what they said. And they, in an interview with the Wall Street Journal, the Symantec senior vice president, Brian Dye is his name, said that antivirus software is dead. And to expound on that, I think what he meant was antivirus software in the consumer market is essentially not selling very well, which is something I think we've known for a while. You know, I got that question. Well, I think it was maybe even the last show. You know, what can you use for a Mac for antivirus? And I just gave the stock answer because I haven't used anything for so long, and you don't hear about it as much. And I think the main reason, and that's not that Symantec is no longer functioning or doing anything. They're just dealing with viruses more on the back end, server side, and things like that, much larger based software. I think for the consumer, it's too big a pain to download and update virus software. Most of the time, it doesn't work anyway because what happens is newer viruses come out and the definitions for those viruses don't get updated to the consumer software until after the virus is already out and likely already caused problems. So I think that's what he was saying, that it doesn't work like it did, say, in the late 90s. Amos, do you have any opinion about that?
Well, you know, and I had read a little bit about this earlier this week, too, and they had said that, you know, antivirus software like Norton or Symantec, I guess, or McAfee or any of the others only catch about between 40 and 50% of the attacks today. Just because so many of the attacks are polymorphic, they change as they propagate. You know, the way antivirus typically works is signature-based, and at its simplest form, basically, here's a list of all the viruses. If you see the virus come through, just don't allow it through. The problem is they get renamed, they change sizes, they change fingerprints, they change just how they are seen to the computer, so that they're not recognized as a known virus. And so really what they're looking at is we need to understand that cyber attacks are changing, and maybe we need to focus more on picking it up once it gets into the computer and stopping it at that point rather than on knowing we're going to see it when it comes through the gateway at first.
Are there any antivirus programs that are doing that right now rather than being a signature-based thing, more of a behavior?
You know, there's other. It's called heuristics, and I think almost every antivirus that I've ever looked at the enterprise level has some sort of heuristics-based antivirus filtering, and that's basically looking for, does this seem like it should be doing what it's doing? And sometimes that's accurate, and more often than not, it's not accurate, just because it's difficult to understand. It's difficult to predict what is good and what's bad, considering the number of people who use computers and the various ways they use them. But, you know, that will get better as they begin to focus on that being the main method of catching people breaking into your systems rather than simply looking at a fingerprint of a file.
Yeah, the I guess the surprising thing for me from the article was, yeah, like 30% of what's out there is being caught, and then the ability to rapidly change your virus, and it morphs into all these things, and it's such a fast turnaround, I guess.
You know, that being said, though, I will never ever suggest to my mother or to anybody else who is the casual computer user to not have an antivirus installed of some sort, whether it's a free version or whether it's the more expensive versions. Having something there, at least you are catching those 40 to 50% of the attacks that are coming through. It's better than nothing.
Yeah, from an enterprise level.
Always so comforting to hear it's better than nothing. That's what everybody wants to hear when it comes to security.
Again, based on the typical casual computer user, it's better than nothing.
No, I think that's good advice, absolutely. I mean, just because, the consumer market frankly, that's probably one of the main reasons the consumer market for antivirus security is dead, is because there are so many free versions and open source versions of virus software. It's a hard market to make money in. It's like if you said, I know, I'm going to make a new web browser and I'm going to charge $100 for it. Yeah, it's not going to last very long. It's just it's the way software goes.
All right. Well, we've got an email from Steve in Brookings, and we haven't heard from Steve in a while. But, man, he's got a lot of things about today's show in here. I'm just going to read through them because we can make comments on them. Actually, let's save that for after the break. We do have to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to hear from Steve in Brookings. And we are back to Dakota Midday Tech Radio for this May 9th in 2014. Our 800 number is 1-800-524-3604. Our email address is midday@sdpb.org, and of course you can tweet us at sdpb. We've got quite a mail here from Steve, and he makes a number of really good points, and that's why we're going to take some time with this. And this was going through my head, Jeff, as we were talking about uninstalling Internet Explorer. He said, wasn't that the basis of the U.S. government monopoly lawsuit against Microsoft, that it wasn't? It was interlocked with the operating system, and you couldn't uninstall it, and you couldn't basically not use it back then. Yep.
Yeah, it was. You know, it was part of it. See, what they did was all browsers have what's called a rendering code engine for HTML and XML and all these fancy, you know, acronyms that are thrown on the web. But those are the protocols that information is sent across the internet. And what these are basically big decoding engines that see these machine code and turns into something that is displayed on your screen and shows pictures and text. Well, they built this in such a way, instead of having each program have its own rendering engine and reuse all the code, is Microsoft said all their products that do anything with HTML, anything with any of these protocols, we just use the IE rendering engine. So when they build into the OS, even the desktop can display HTML. When it does that, it actually is using the IE engine to display that on your screen. So everything Microsoft and a lot of Microsoft third-party programs did is, hey, there's this free engine here. Let's just use it for everything because then we don't have to reinvent the wheel every time. So, and it speeds up, development and stuff. So a lot of programs use the core IE engine to function. So if when you remove that, they can no longer function. And Microsoft maybe on purpose made it harder to even remove and to get around some of these lawsuits and some of the legal problems, dug it in deep. There's actually versions in other countries that don't have IE. But the trick is they have IE, you just can't run it from the desktop. It's still in the core system. You just don't have the icons, or there's no way for you to type it at a command prompt to actually run it. But all the core functionality, all the stuff that still has to be patched and stuff, is still embedded in the OS. So, and if you use Chrome and other browsers, they actually use part of the IE engine for certain things too. So while they use their own HTML rendering engine and JavaScript engines and stuff like that, some of those third-party ones, when they run on Windows, will actually use some of the IE programs and libraries too to actually run too. So, it's a spaghetti complex creature inside that core OS that touches just about everything in the OS now.
All right. Well, and here's something. So he goes on, and this is a little over my head, but Aviator Browser, have you used that at all, Jeff? So he says in Windows 8.1, it's got sandbox memory, and he says it's a pretty solid fix to kind of the security issue.
No, I haven't used that one. There's actually a lot of browsers we don't talk about regularly out there on many platforms. Some are paid. Some you have to pay for. Some are free. Opera is a very big browser still, but you have to pay for it, and we don't talk about it much, but it's a valid third-party browser. So there's a lot of different browsers you can use and stuff. I'm just not familiar with that one.
Okay. He also speaks a little bit about the CAD and Google and makes a pitch for actually jumping from the kind of the free or low-cost version into a really serious one. And he talks about a number of architectural firms and industrial firms in Sioux Falls and even some hospitals that use the professional, ePro, AutoCAD sort of things. And I think that's what you're alluding to, Joel, right?
Yeah.
The AutoCADs and
AutoCAD, yep.
And all that. So, I understand. And I think Steve's concern in this paragraph is that he's really a little wary of the Google aspect of the program and your privacy, let's just put it that way. So if anybody wants to take off on that, go ahead. But otherwise, we're gonna move on in the show. We're getting tight, folks. And finally, he says Bromium and or a firewall sort of add-ons like FireWatch are his favorite. Severa, you heard of those, Amos?
Yeah, there's actually a lot of tools out there, Severa being one that, if I'm not mistaken, I think that's a Palo Alto company now, actually, who makes hardware firewalls for the enterprise market. But each of them, tend to have something that can be installed on the end user workstation so that if you've got like a traveling user who goes from inside the corporate firewall to whatever hotel he or she happens to be staying at, they've got some sort of protection there. I've not used it, but I've heard the term or I've heard the name before. And there's a lot of those that are associated to if you take a piece of software, whether it's antivirus or just malware in general, kind of software or anti-malware, you'll find it associated with a large firewall company for that exact reason. And my take on it is there is a lot of software that you could get installed that could make sure that you're staying safe. There's no one piece of software out there that's going to be the magic key. And it's one of those things that you just need to be careful about the software, about the information that you're sending out. And if you truly don't want it to be mishandled or given out or seen by anybody else, don't use the internet. That's really the only way.
Yeah, okay. Jeff, you have any comments about Bromium or FireWatch, Severa, any of the other I'm assuming these are more on the professional end of products.
Yeah. I just really don't have – it's kind of funny. 10 years ago, I did actually have a lot of experience in different parts of this stuff, but I just really, haven't kept up and just don't have the experience much to talk about that kind of stuff at this point.
That's fine. So. I'll tell you what I'm going to do is I'm going to list them. The Aviator browser kind of intrigues me, and some other things about these links. So I'm going to post them out on Facebook. Folks can take those for what they are. They can do their own research and explore those. And Steve, thank you so much for passing those along, and we appreciate that and letting us know your feelings on that. And it's always good to learn new things. We also had a comment. Douglas wrote in. He subscribes to Fine Home Building and regularly sees ads for their book using SketchUp for building and other woodworking. So he's got a link. I'm going to pass that along as well on Facebook and in an email back to the guy that was interested in that. So a number of good comments on today's show, and certainly we'll get those passed along and get those out there. I want to again remind folks that if there's a link or the audio that they'd like to listen to from today's show, we post those out to the web. Listen.sdpb.org is where you'll, of course, find the podcast for the show. And the other links and things are at Facebook.com. So Facebook.com/TechRadio is where you can go. certainly the do-it-yourself community is getting bigger and bigger, and I think this kind of comes out of there, Joel.
Yeah, you know, SketchUp, you know, we got the email from the person that said that it was in fine home building. I'm kind of a hobby woodworker myself, and at least two or three of the magazines in the past couple of years have done stories on Google SketchUp. It's big in the kind of do-it-yourself and maker market, which is, you know, right up our alley, whether you're doing stuff with wood or metal or whatever. And it's great to get your ideas and be able to replicate that. And you can go right from Google SketchUp into a 3D printer, something we haven't mentioned.
And a
commenter said, you know, you got to be careful because when you use Google SketchUp, your stuff is visible to Google. I don't think that's a huge concern to people that are using a free program or free or very inexpensive program, because you're just trying to kind of get your ideas out, and you want to get this chair built, and you know, if somebody's really, really worried about your design, they're going to rip your chair design off. I don't think that's a huge concern for the people that are in the market for Google SketchUp. And really, I don't think SketchUp would be very big if it wasn't for the do-it-yourself community. It didn't really have legs, and I think there was a time that Google was going to stop supporting it, but there was just a huge uproar of people that were using it that wanted to continue using it. So,
hey, I've got a Google question for Amos quick at the end of the show here. Have you seen the articles lately about the fiber basically driving driving expansion of their rivals' bandwidth and things in certain cities? If they even hint or announce that they're going to go into a city, all of a sudden it sparks overbuilding and other things from their competition.
It does, and you know, that overbuilding, frankly, is expensive. It's one of those things that we see quite frequently. Actually, is, you know, smaller areas, smaller communities where it takes quite a bit of effort, time, and money to get those facilities out to those locations. Maybe other companies drag their feet on it, but Google being who they are and the way they do things, sometimes if they're going to come in and you know, Kansas City is a great example where they just overbuilt that, you know, it sparks the competition, and I guess that's where the idea that competition's good for everybody. It brings more services into more places. But Google being that behemoth who has the financial resources to build out those spots that maybe some of the others have either procrastinated on or just decided it wasn't worth their time and energy, have decided maybe it's a good idea now.
Yeah. You know, for the home user, are things going to get more reasonably priced, or for the same amount of money, are we going to get better service, or
you know,
how is this all going to play out on us?
That's sort of the thing that we're seeing, is that pricing typically doesn't get any cheaper. I think, you know, pricing is maybe at or about the sweet spot where people are willing to pay, but it's the speeds that go up. You know, the price that I'm paying for internet service today, where I'm getting 50 meg down, I was paying, you know, 10 years ago for a T1 line or a 1 point, actually maybe not even that much, significantly less. And so rather than pricing getting any cheaper, we're seeing the bandwidths getting bumped up, or maybe bundled services coming in as part of that, maybe some other things, you know, access to clouds, maybe some email services, other things. But typically it's the price stays about the same.
Yeah, all right. Joel, what's this about Plants vs. Zombies 2?
Yeah, just came across it when I was looking at other Apple news, that it's apparently their birthday. And Plants vs. Zombies, if you're not aware of it, Jeff probably knows way more about this than I do. But it's a $5 program. It's free on the iOS, on the App Store right now. So you can download it through the end of May for free.
We try to have a broad spectrum of stories we talk about on today's show.
And that's the most important one there, I think.
I think we went from free
and
Plants
vs.
Zombies.
And the most addicting if you get into it, too, so be warned.
Oh, my. So I want to thank our panelists for joining us today. Of course, Joel Brovelite, Amos Asaf, and Jeff Litterick in Pier. Thank you so much, guys, for spending your time with us. I hope you all have a fantastic Mother's Day weekend, as the listeners to the show as well. And a reminder to listeners, if you would like a list of the links that we talked about on today's show, we're going to post those to the web, facebook.com/techradio. To sign up for podcasts of this and other great programs from South Dakota Public Radio, listen.sdpb.org. Have a great weekend, everybody, and join us for Science Friday next.